My thesis is the reason zombies are popular right now is because people are afraid that democracy isn't working.
Yeah.
And my reasoning for that is all monsters are a fantastic way of processing real human fears. A monster doesn't succeed in literature unless it's a metaphor for something human. And what makes a zombie unique among monsters is that it outnumbers the survivor. Every other monster is the village versus the individual, whereas zombies is the zombies versus the individual. Like
absolutely.
The village versus the survivor. So and so they're a majoritarian monster. They're your neighbors, they're your family, they are those who outnumber you and want to eat you against your will.
Hey everybody, welcome back to School Sucks. It's a podcast. A podcast is like a radio show made for the internet you can listen to whenever you want with no commercial breaks. Brand new stuff. So we continue with our Liberty Forum discussion series. This is part three, one of my favorite interviews of all time with a long overdue guest named Davi Barker. His website's shinybadges.com. That's a very cool merch site. And you can also get a sense of the breadth and the depth of his work at his website, davibarker.com, D-A-B-I. So, unfortunately, there was a little snag with this one. This was the first interview we recorded at Liberty Forum, and it was done a little haphazardly. I was told that the Free Talk Live equipment would be available for like a one-hour window on Friday night. So we rushed in there and set everything up, and everything looked fine. And I even took extra time to make sure the levels looked right. You know, it's funny, just a couple of shows ago, I was bragging about, hey, now when we have a problem, I know what caused the problem. Well, folks, we had a problem, and I don't know what caused it. The audio is a bit distorted. I wanted this to be the first release. I spent days trying to make the audio quality better, and I accept full responsibility for whatever this unidentified problem was. But you're going to learn a lot about them zombies in this one. You know, where do they come from? Are they coming to get us? Are there certain plants you could put in your backyard to help ward off their mass attacks? We will see. This is Davi Barker, Liberty Forum Discussion Series Part 3. More stuff is coming soon. In just a couple of days, we'll have Part 4. Thanks for listening, everybody. Please go to our website, schoolsucksproject.com, to see show notes and to leave comments. If you want to participate in some of our ongoing discussions, the School Sucks Project Facebook group is a great place to do that. Follow me on Twitter, School Sucks Show. Why not? And subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you're a fairly new listener, we used to do a lot of stuff on YouTube. We're gearing up to do more stuff on YouTube in the future, but go get caught up. School Sucks Podcast is the username to search. Thanks so much, everyone. Here we go.
So this is School Sucks, live from Liberty Forum to a big empty room. This is very nice. Carlos is joining me to co-host our first interview of 2015. Davi Barker, long overdue.
How's it going? I've never been on School Sucks,
you
really?
You never have been on School Sucks.
I find that hard to believe.
I find it hard to believe, too. I find it's an outrage.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. First of all, your website?
DaviBarker.com is the main one. But shinybadges.com is probably what I'm most known for.
And you're also a fiend, Freedom Fiend.
I'm a Freedom Fiend at freedomfiends.com.
And one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about today was a series of books you're writing. But before we get into like a formal interview here, I really have to, I have to vent a little bit. I just came from a talk about free schools, like alternative education. Mm-hmm. It was right across the way, and I was so disappointed. And I didn't want to be like the guy in the speech who, you know, somebody, if you've ever given a speech and someone's in the audience and they're like, I see that your name is on the schedule and you are the man at the front of the room with the microphone, but I'd like to act as if I was supposed to be that man. So I didn't want to be that guy. And Wes was in there with me, and I could tell he had some objections. But the guy was talking about, we were hoping that some of our fears about these democratic schools, you know, would be relieved from hearing him talk, but okay. They were only intensified. Like the Sudbury model. Are you familiar with the Sudbury model?
Yeah, I'm not so familiar with Sudbury. I know the word Worcestershire is coming to mind, but that is not the right word. Waldorf.
Well, we've been talking about starting a school here in New Hampshire, so I think we just found the name.
The Worcestershire.
Worcestershire. Sounds very British, very old.
And saucy.
Yeah, and saucy. Tangy.
So, oh, by the way, I just want to let people know this is the first interview that we've done, and we're on the Free Talk Live equipment, so we have kind of a mix and match set up here. So please excuse any imperfections in the audio quality. We will get it right before the end of the event. Let's talk about Survivor Max. I love this series of books that you're writing, and you've written one is out, published and out, and you're...
One is published, and the second one is written and should be published soon. And I'm writing the third book now.
So give us just the abstract first, and then we'll get into specific
questions. The abstract is Home Alone with Zombies. Max is 11 years old, and he's by himself surviving in the zombie apocalypse. And so he's too small to fight zombies and has to use booby traps and snares and be clever about it.
And you think it has some like how-to value for kids as far as like survivalism and all that is concerned?
Yeah. Max is part of a fictional group called the Porcupine Freedom Scouts.
Yeah.
And he has some sort of basic scouts training about how to build a fire or how to smoke and preserve meat or, you know, things like that. How to tie certain knots is explained in the book. And that's all. I was not a scout. This is all stuff I've had to learn along the way. So there is a survival element that's about, like, here's what kids can do in a survival scenario. And also about building a bug out bag and stuff like that. But there's also some metaphor I'm working with about the zombies and what I think they mean and stuff like that.
Do you know about this? The zombies? These zombies?
I do know about the zombies, and I am a fan of your work, so I'm glad to have you on the show here.
I like this. You described it to me yesterday. I'm forgetting the term that you used. The zombies, the intensity of their dysfunction. How does that work in the story?
So let's just start zombies in general.
Yeah.
This is my talk tomorrow. It's I have a talk tomorrow morning called The Undead Democracy Apocalypse.
Yeah.
And my thesis is the reason zombies are popular right now is because people are afraid that democracy isn't working.
Yeah.
And my reasoning for that is all monsters are a fantastic way of processing real human fears. A monster doesn't succeed in literature unless it's a metaphor for something human. And what makes a zombie unique among monsters is that it outnumbers the survivor. Every other monster is the village versus the individual, whereas zombies is the zombies versus the individual, like
Absolutely.
The village versus the survivor. So they're a majoritarian monster. They're your neighbors. They're your family. They are those who outnumber you and want to eat you against your will, right?
That's the key.
It exemplifies the fear of the other, which, I mean, the fact that zombies got popular right after the Stranger Danger generation is, you know, followed up from there.
What's the dumb masses?
Yeah.
Right? So,
this is such a... I just want to stop and say this is such a beautiful follow-up to me sitting through a talk for an hour about how wonderful democratic schools are and how the majority rules. And it's also this epiphany for me because I never understood zombies. I'm like, fucking go upstairs. You know? They can't, if you have a building with an elevator, there's no way they would be able to figure out how an elevator works. There's no way they'd know what floor you're on. Go to an island. Can they swim? You know, like it seems like it always comes down to we better go into this dark place with one way out to get more supplies where all the zombies are sleeping and we didn't think of that.
This horror trope of heroes being stupid, this is another thing I'm trying to combat. I'm really trying to put... Max is either going to do the smart thing that I'm sick and tired of other heroes doing the dumb thing, or he's going to do the dumb thing because he's a kid and it's not going to work.
Right.
That's another sort of frustration I have with the genre.
Well, the other interesting thing, though, about the genre is how, you know, especially something like Walking Dead, where the enemy is no longer just the zombies, it's the inner tribe themselves.
The other humans. And that's the thing that Max is, he's on the fourth floor of an apartment building. That's part of why he survives as long as he does.
Right.
There's literally an elevator they can't use.
Yeah.
And he uses it. But the other thing is, what do you do next? Like, what do you do once you start encountering humans and they're just as scavenging for supplies as you are and they can climb your whatever? But so I want to go back to the genre, because let me get you from the genre of zombies to where Survivor Max is.
Absolutely, yeah.
In the zombie genre, fans are very upset and constantly arguing about what zombies are and how they work.
Yeah.
So there's runners and walkers. There's talkers and moaners. There's are they fast? Are they slow? Are they smart? Are they dumb? Is it a virus? Is it a magic? Is it, you know? And so I have an M theory of zombies that explains how all of the zombies of all of the genres can exist simultaneously.
Nice.
And it is that the zombie disease keeps what it can use and destroys what it can't. So if you're an aggressive person, the disease is going to keep more of your brain, and you're going to be a higher functioning, more intelligent zombie. So in the beginning, your like average everyday human being turns into the moaner shambler of the Night of the Living Dead, which is what most people consider canonical zombies.
Yeah.
But the postman, who's a bureaucrat, he's slightly higher functioning.
Interesting, right? Just because he stores more aggression naturally?
Because he stores more aggression.
This is such a perfect metaphor for the state.
I know.
Jesus, that's so good.
It also relates to what I always say on the show about alcohol, hallucinogens, money, and the internet.
Yeah.
It just pushes you faster down whatever road you're already going.
Exactly. Right.
In the first book, Max is just observing 90% of the zombies are all the shamblers,
yeah.
And there's this one that's different, and then there's some psychology about why is he different, and how do they treat him because he's different. So fundamentally, the only intelligence that the postman has is that he has this muscle memory of going door to door,
yeah,
right? And so that is, in the zombie apocalypse, a search pattern, which is an incredible survival mechanism for a zombie, whereas most zombies will just bang on one door until they rot to death. This one goes to the next door and goes to the next door and goes to the next door. And because he looks like he knows what he's doing, the shamblers follow him.
Yeah.
And so he has this posse, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so then he goes to the next door and he knocks and nothing happens. But pretty soon the posse's so big, he's just breaking down doors. And so once this mob gets large enough, the apartment building Max is in is no longer safe because they're going to make it up the stairs. They're going to break down the doors. And because of this one zombie with this one small evolutionary adaptation of being slightly more intelligent because he's slightly more aggressive, he becomes incredibly dangerous. Now, this is just the first book. It's just the postman. It's just the post office. It's not that aggressive, right? But as we get into the second book, I like to think of the second book as Animal Farm with zombies.
Yeah.
Max is taken involuntarily into a refugee center at his middle school. The second book is called School Bites.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is the faculty, which is essentially your socialist party, and the local police, which is essentially your fascist party.
Yeah.
And they're running this school as a refugee center with these bizarre rules. But now you have former police officers who've become zombies.
Mm.
And they actually track, like, They strategize. They recognize Max and follow him, whereas he's learned to disguise himself from all the other zombies. So what's the deal with these new police officer zombies? There's this whole new question of why are they different from the others? And he starts to figure it out when he finds in the library a book by his mother. His mother died before he was born, but she wrote a book called Psycho Class A. Mm-hmm. You might know Psycho Class from the Bomb in the Brain stuff.
Yeah, sure.
And she's done the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, and she's broken the test subjects into five categories, psychoclass A, B, C, D, and E, and has described them. But she can't find a sufficient number of test subjects of psychoclass A, which is the zero aggression category.
Right, right.
And so she and her husband and some other parents got together and started the Porcupine Freedom Scouts to raise children as psychoclass A.
Interesting.
You see where I'm going?
Yeah, yeah.
So now that he has this sort of profile of what does aggression look like in the brain, it becomes clear that, like, a psychoclass B zombie is your 90% of the bell curve. Your psychoclass C zombie is your postman. Your psychoclass D zombie is your policeman. What is psychoclass E? We haven't seen it yet. And what is psychoclass A?
Right, because we don't know what that looks like. So E is the big reveal, though, that's
well,
coming.
This is the third book. The title of the third book is, I haven't really decided. I kind of want to call it Pork Scouts. I kind of want to call it Psychoclass A. But the third book is when he meets Dr. Stephanie Murphy, who is this neurobiologist who's he's been listening to on this, like, underground radio station. And she is able to not only interpret his mother's research, but apply it to her own research on the zombie disease and realize that they're related.
So that actually brings up this question of, was it more the inspiration for writing the book, was it more the zombie angle than the actual, like, survival how-to angle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was much more interested, because it's like you're saying, for me, the zombies are the metaphor for the state.
Yeah.
Right? And so when you're talking about your book that explains everything, you're explaining how adverse childhood experiences explain the state.
Yeah.
So my thesis is, here's how adverse childhood experience explains the zombies, which is a metaphor for the state.
Yeah.
Right? But people like prepper stuff, and that's part of the genre, and it was something I'm interested in, too, that I needed an excuse to research.
Yeah.
And so, plus the publisher is a prepper-oriented, it's Prepper Press, and they focus on either survival manuals or apocalypse fiction.
Did you experiment with other protagonists before you start, or did it just fall into place that, yeah, this should be somebody who's young?
I wanted to... Okay, so backstory. This was originally an alien story, and the original protagonist was a Somali kid named Hakim.
Because why wouldn't it be?
Right. So I originally... The original concept was that Hakim was being raised in Somalia in 2026 or 29 or something like that.
Yeah.
And that global hegemony had tried to squash the internet because they realized that Occupy movements and Tea Party movements and Arab Spring and all these things were organizing on the internet. So totalitarians needed to control the internet. And so this liberty-oriented internet service provider decided if they wanted uninterruptible, uninterceptible internet access, it would need to be somewhere without a government. And so they built their headquarters in Somalia.
Yeah.
And, right. And then, of course, aliens are voluntarists. They're the anarchists of space. And the idea was that if you're an aggressive species, you either blow up your rock or never get off it. Like, you pretty much have to be a peaceful species to advance enough to get off your rock.
Yeah.
And so Pirate Bay, which is the name of the alien, B-E-I-G-H is Turkish for sovereign. So the Pirate Bay is this alien looking for Psycho Class A on Earth to make sure the Earth evolves in the way to get off its rock instead of blowing itself up. So this is the problem I had, was this required such tremendous amounts of research, both to first study Somalia and figure out what does a teenager in Somalia look like, and then once the alien finds him, what does the teenager in China look like, what does the teenager in all these places. And
it's easier if they're all just dead, so you don't really have to research those. So you can just set it up for a zombie thing.
Well, this comes from Taron Lupo. I went to him and I said, look, I'm having a real problem with writer's block here because I'm doing more research than having fun, and I don't know how to move forward with this story that is so big and so many components and so whatever. And he said, you need to stop trying to write an epic trilogy on your first try and write what you know and what you like.
Good advice, yeah, absolutely.
And so... New Hampshire and zombies. Like, my favorite genre is zombies. So instead of the 13 Psycho Class A kids from all over the world, I went with one Psycho Class A kid in a place that I knew, in a community that I knew.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was it. So I left Liberty Forum a couple of years ago. Maybe it was only 1 year ago. I'm not sure.
Which Liberty Forum is this for you? How many have you been to?
I think this is my third.
I think so, too.
So it's probably last year.
Yep.
And... So I'm like, chapter one kid in New Hampshire. And I'm sitting on this plane, like, just writing chapter one of the zombie story. And this woman sitting next to me is a middle school teacher grading short stories written by her science class about zombies.
Interesting.
So I don't remember whether I saw the word zombie in her paper or she saw the word zombie in my paper, but one of us was reading over the other one's shoulder and broke a conversation. And she tells me she's using zombies to teach her science middle school class about viruses.
Yeah.
And half the class is writing about hidden viruses, and half the class is writing about open viruses or what are visible viruses.
Yeah, yeah.
And she gives me all their stories. She says, here, read these. So a lot of Max's ideas are straight out of her class. They're what these kids understood about viruses, what these kids understood about zombies. The way that Max fights zombies is largely to do with them. So they had a rule that they couldn't use firearms in the story because zero tolerance policies in public schools.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also had a rule that I didn't want firearms in my story. And so I put Max in a gated community where firearms were prohibited by the housing agreement. And the reason for that was because, for me, in a zombie story, the firearm dispels the tension. You know? Like, if you can just start shooting them all in the head, they become this manageable threat too fast for me. And I wanted Max to be in these perilous situations.
Yeah.
So I took firearms away from him for the first book.
Wow. Yeah, I like that.
And so a lot of Max's ideas are their ideas. Like, he uses a gallon of ketchup to slip them up. He straps it to his back with a ripcord. So when he's ready to run and the zombies are going to go after him, he pulls the ripcord and trails ketchup on the ground. And the zombies all slip and fall on it. That was these kids' idea, one of the kids in this class. And so I dedicated the book to them.
That's awesome. In a world where most people have become zombies, there's probably going to be a condiment surplus pretty quickly.
Here's the thing. It turns out that Max's neighbor, who's dead now, was a ketchup entrepreneur, and he had gallons and gallons of ketchup, all with different recipes, trying to perfect exactly the perfect agarist ketchup recipe. And so it was just going to waste.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was an opportunity to talk about what does a home-based entrepreneur do.
That's very cool. You know, we want to expand, though, to the science fiction genre more generally.
Essentially, you know, a lot of the libertarian information that got out to the public in the 60s and 70s was a result of sci-fi.
I'm going to write The Pirate Bay eventually, but it's about building muscle, right? Like, The Pirate Bay was too big a story for me to try on my first novel. And now it's like, so I finished Survivor Max 1, and it was honestly pretty difficult. It's difficult to finish a book.
No kidding.
And so then, like, I take on the second book. The second book is 50% longer. It's longer. It's more in-depth. There's a dozen more characters. Like, the first book is one, maybe two characters, and against a predictable enemy.
Yeah.
The second book, there's dozens of people in this refugee center, and they all have motivations, and they all have good and evil, and it gets complex. And so for me, this is also about learning to develop the skill of telling a story and actually finishing a novel, because I've started and failed to finish 5 or 6 novels in my life.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, The Pirate Bay is coming eventually.
Do you see that as a trilogy, too?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, the way you were describing the story, too, it makes me wonder, and I think I brought this up somewhere before, if we could turn that alien, but like the enlightened alien genre around, and if the aliens that did come here were complete idiots and statists. Like, I think that idea has... Have I ever talked to you about this?
No.
I think this idea has potential that instead of the alien... Because this is a typical, you know, idea that's expressed that if aliens did come here, they would be enlightened, they would be peaceful. Otherwise, how would they have survived long enough to travel this far into space? But, I mean, the United States and Great Britain had no problem traveling all over this planet, you know?
So, Bay addresses this in the story.
Okay, yeah. Let's talk about that.
Bay... he comes to Earth. What makes him a pirate, there's no laws in space, so he's not a pirate in conventional means, but what it is he violates best practices for intergalactic trade, and that is that he is visiting a planet that has not really been cleared as peaceful. He's coming to Earth looking for peaceful people, and he's hoping to open a new market. That's what he's up to. If he can find enough Psycho Class A on Earth to convince his constituents that this is a market worth opening, then they'll bring these fantastic new products, right?
Right.
And the first thing he does is he shows Hakim a slideshow, or I guess a reel of various movies like Starship Troopers or Alien or all of these movies where the aliens are hostile. And he says, why does your planet assume that we're hostile? Why does your planet assume that we're all hive-minded and imperialistic and bug-like when we're actually this sort of individualist and enlightened thing?
Like
he doesn't even identify by his species. He finds the idea in Star Trek that people are categorized by species offensive and racist. And he says that this is not anything you people think about us. This is what you people think about yourselves, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's his point. He says, I'm trying to make him as radically individualist as possible, if that makes sense.
Right.
That is a huge difference than most sci-fi whenever they talk about aliens, which is all the hive mind type stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of times, again, it's just the fear of the other group. And that's that you just solidify that in whatever kind of enemy that you want to create in whatever particular genre.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the sci-fi topic, though, we were talking about earlier, you know, Moon is a Harsh Mistress, which was written before we even landed on the moon. And it basically brought up things like the internet and a lot of other technologies they didn't even have at the time. What sci-fi allows for is it gives the author so many different abilities because you're speaking in a sense of a time that has not occurred yet. So if you're talking about technology in the future, you're also able to talk about different types of lifestyles in the future and be able to create new ideas based off of that.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Harsh Mistress actually does a really good job in regards to different marriages and different ideas on how to treat other individuals. It actually, oddly enough, all the polyamory talk in the libertarian community, mm-hmm. a lot of that is brought up in the Moon as a Harsh Mistress due to the scarcity of women.
It's also, I didn't realize the scarcity.
Yeah, it's a scarcity. Well, that's the entire reason why they have kind of polyamory in the book, is because of the scarcity of women, and therefore it leads to this.
In Stranger in a Strange Land, it's sort of just the normative practice of Michael Valentine Smith and his group.
Heinlein might have had a thing for it, and he just kind of just teased in any single thing he wrote.
It's funny, they squeezed it out of the show, but in the comic book, Carol, Rick, and Lori flirt with the idea of a polyamorous marriage. And they sort of say, like, well, the law of society has collapsed. We can't very well abide by these rules that worked in that society now. When
you're talking about Walking Dead, correct?
Yeah, in the Walking Dead comic book, Carol proposes to Lori
and
Rick. Yeah.
That's great. Because that's the weird thing about the show is how many of them aren't trying to get laid with the other
weird,
partners.
Right?
Like, it just doesn't feel real to me at all.
Yeah.
The most real relationship was the initial relationship regarding Rick.
Rick and Lori.
Yeah, Rick and Lori. I mean, that was
Andrea and Shane have kind of a fling out in the woods at one point.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, Glenn and Maggie, obviously.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
The first time an Asian guy ever gets to hook up with a white woman. That's something that does not happen in Hollywood.
I don't think that's a first. That's a first.
It's incredibly rare. Like,
You mean it on screen?
On screen. If you take a look at like Jackie Chan films, Jet Li films, all these different films where you have Asian action heroes, they never end up hooking up with white women.
Yeah.
They'll save them. They'll do all these things. Like even Romeo Must Die. I know this is totally tangential. Romeo Must Die, like Jet Li is talking to Aaliyah, who's a black woman in this case, like kind of romantic flirting and everything else, and even at the end they still don't give it to him. So Walking Dead, there was actually, like, I was reading some forums with Asian Americans who were talking about, yes, this is the first time they ever get laid.
Yeah. Another reason to sort of focus on young characters is this doesn't enter into it. Like, this is very complex for me, and it's going to take me some development to write convincing romantic relationships, so adventure is a nice sort of safe place to start.
And you also have a market. You know, you have what I'm saying is you have a market with non-romantic relationships, because a lot of the times that just ends up convoluting what you're writing about in the stories, and it ends up just becoming a romance story.
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, was Twilight supposed to be more than that?
It was a Mormon saga.
Yeah.
I mean, it was written by someone who obviously had a bit of a Stockholm syndrome whenever it comes to the relationship dynamics. So Twilight was more like that. Hunger Games, it kind of depends on whether you're going by the books or the movies.
Right, right.
Because there's some very important messages that are within the book and the movie, obviously, as well. And the way you sell that to teenagers is through the angst of relationships and everything and how it creates chaos there.
And he might grow into it. He's 11 in the first book. He's 12 in the second book. If it's a series, he's going to get older. I'm going to do the Harry Potter thing, right, where he starts out as this very young character and he goes through puberty and adolescence. And, you know, I'll develop him as a character.
And hopefully you'll make more money than the Queen. You know, after you're done with everything, just like Harry Potter, you'll be good to go.
Why do you guys think that's so important to these stories?
Relationships or sexual relationships?
That romance angle is so important. I mean, like, there's so few movies where it doesn't come into the mix.
Because that's the reason why we're here. Reproduction. I mean, human beings, outside of the whole technological progress and everything else, but so many of that relies on whether or not we're going to be able to reproduce and keep the civilization going.
Did you ever see Speed?
The
Keanu Reeves on a bus.
Yeah.
There's this whole thing in that movie about Sandra Bullock.
This is a good example. Yeah.
Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock, there's no real romantic, there's not even any romantic development.
Right.
Right? Like, they're just partners in a crisis.
Yeah.
But they're explicit when they hook up at the end that it's this, like, psychological trick that people feel these intense, like, lust or romantic feelings after a crisis, that it's almost like a mutual Stockholm syndrome, right? So I wonder if that's true. If Sandra Bullock didn't lie to me, and I don't know whether or not she lied to me, maybe it's that action movies make us think romance. I mean, what if that's the case?
The other dynamic as well is, at least within Hollywood writing and everything, the men in particular don't go to movie theaters by themselves. Women will go to movie theaters by themselves, and they'll bring their boyfriends with them. If you don't have some kind of relationship thing to them, at least in that market, it's going to be boring unless there's some kind of relationship going on.
Yeah, all these answers make sense.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's very few examples of movies I can think where there's not at least a hint of that, but it, you know,
it, or you dangle it over the audience for years and years, like X-Files or Bones, right?
And it's also the hero deserves to get laid, you know, that's also part of it. You know, if you're gonna win, you might as well get the girl on top of it, because God knows that's why we do everything.
Yeah,
at least in most people's mindset.
Well, no, I mean, if you look at other forms of media like television, or like even if you look at television advertising, the end of any product marketed towards a guy is like, you are going to have sex.
Yeah.
You know, if you take it all the way.
Wear Axe body spray, you'll get laid.
Oh, no, no, no. I mean, that's like, that is, I actually appreciate that style more. They're just direct. It's like, you go to the drugstore.
What's the subtle version?
Give the guy behind the counter $5, put on whatever the stuff is, get laid.
Yeah.
Right? I mean.
And then you have like Jared's Diamonds, which is buy a woman with a ring.
Yep. Exactly.
Which is pretty much because it's forever.
Right.
So therefore, it's totally fine on that end.
So in the second Survivor Max book, one more question. You said behaviorism comes up, that's actually a theme in the book.
Yeah. So, again, it's a school.
Yeah.
His middle school has been sort of co-opted first by the health department, and then the faculty and the police sort of vie for as a controlling party of the infrastructure. I based it on Occupy, actually. The school counselor is sort of an Occupy type woman, and so she does the whole consensus process and this jazz. Sure. And then there's a military major that shows up and just claims, no arbitrary authority, I get to say.
Yeah.
And there's conflict there. But his science teacher, the woman from the first book, Ms. Lessard, who's the woman on the airplane in real life, she is trying to understand them. And so she's doing these sort of behavior tests, trying to figure out what's the psychology of these zombies, how do we figure out what to do with them. And so she's applying the behaviorist stuff that she was applying originally to students to see if she can condition certain behavior in the zombies. And so it's a matter of you need a punishment and a reward. And so she discovers, well, they'll eat things other than humans. And so they have a big rat problem. And so she starts feeding them rats as rewards. But then the problem is punishment, because they don't respond to pain, right? Zombies traditionally don't respond to injury or pain, or where they're just relentless forward moving.
Mm-hmm.
But she discovers, and this is again why this is a metaphor for the state, that even though they don't care about pain, they really hate losing control. And so the effective punishment for a zombie is the taser.
Yeah.
Because it's involuntary muscle spasms. They really like being able to reach, being able to grab, being able to chew. They like being in control of their muscular system. And so when you hijack it from them and you cause these involuntary seizures, they hate that. And once they learn that the zapping sound means the involuntary seizures, sort of in a Pavlovian way, that becomes the fear. That becomes a trainable punishment.
Interesting. So just to jump in really quickly, for those who are unfamiliar, behaviorism is something that we've discussed on the show in the past years. You can just go to the website and search for it, and you'll find what we've done. But basically, this idea that B.F. Skinner introduced that became intentionally, or some people would argue unintentionally, so prevalent in the schools was the system of carrots and sticks, right? Mm-hmm. And it was from people like Pavlov, like B.F. Skinner, who, instead of spending time around other humans in their research, spent time around dogs and rats and pigeons, and basically extrapolated from that experience how humanity could be managed with, you know, ultimate efficiency. And they would say for the ultimate good. So that's the idea. It became, if you've been to school, you've experienced behaviorism in action. You said you were looking for maybe to flesh it out a little bit better in the book.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. Like, put your mind in like the arch statist science teacher. What do you do to a zombie? What do you try to train it to do? What purpose does it serve? Or is it just enough to discover that it can be that it can learn from punishment and reward? Or
what's a matter of what you're trying to get out of it?
But how is that maintained? Like, what's the contingency plan? Like, it seems like you'd always just be putting out fires. And I mean, I guess that's if I was.
Well, I'll give you. Oh, there's a practical
the state
application.
Central planner. That's what I would do, I guess, just going around putting out all the fires that I created in a circle.
Yeah.
But
so I did not connect this before, but there is a practical application in the book, and that is that the bell system still works.
Yeah.
That they are holed up inside the school. The yard outside the school is overwhelmed with zombies, and the only reason they're alive is because the zombies don't know they're inside, and the zombies don't break down the doors.
Yeah.
And the way they keep the zombies calm and under control is they keep the bell system going. So every time the bell goes off for lunch or first period or sixth period or whatever, all the zombies line up on the classroom numbers. And then when the next bell goes off, all the zombies wander away from the school. And it's like, because in life they understood the meaning of that bell system, in death they do too.
I love that.
Although I didn't connect that with behaviorism, but that totally is
that
behaviorism.
Yeah,
absolutely.
What's the other things that people would be trained to respond to and potentially remember if all they have is the most basic of muscle memory?
Fear comes to mind, but I don't know how that transfers into, you know, muscle memory.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's one of the most important aspects of training.
I imply that uniforms works.
Yeah.
There's a camp, not the school, but S-Mart. S-Mart is a group of survivors that have holed up in a shopping mall. And they've discovered that because all of the zombies in their area are in S-Mart uniforms, if they also dress in S-Mart uniforms, they're able to train the zombies not to see them as food, but to take the uniform as a symbol of a fellow zombie. And as a result, they're able to lead packs of zombies as armies or weapons.
Right.
Yeah. So they use zombies as weapons for themselves? Yeah. So against other zombies?
To invade the school.
Oh, to invade the school.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, see, that would be my thinking. I mean, that's what makes the most sense. If I saw, like, a powerful force like that, and I was in that status, you know, central planner, controller mindset, I would want to know, how could I harness this power for myself, right? Because there's humans left.
Yeah.
Right? And they're part of the antagonists in the story as well, I would assume, and they will become increasingly so.
So in the second book, it's sort of unwitting antagonism, right? It's these fascists with the best of intentions. You know what I mean? But there is fundamentally a fight over resources, because everybody is forming these search parties to go into the towns to bring back enough food to keep their encampment fed, because nobody's growing anything, nobody's producing anything. Mostly they spend their time in general assemblies arguing about various policies, like whether or not it should be 4 bells a day or 6 bells a day. So you end up with that resource conflict, where when you encounter another group of survivors, they have resources you need. So do you trade or raid?
And this is a very big theme in prepper world too, that, you know, this will be one of the biggest threats.
These
hordes.
Preppers call them zombies. That's sort of prepper slang for the unprepared.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is sort of funny.
Well, I just imagine those people dying, you know, very quickly. What I'm worried about, and what they actually have, I've heard people talk about, is that there are forces assembling who believe, as much as the preppers do, that the end is near, whatever that means, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're not preparing to survive for you know, their own survival and the survival
they're
of their
loved ones. They're preparing to hunt preppers.
They are preparing to hunt even people who are prepared.
Right. Right.
So those people, I think, would be out there in your story, too. And the idea of how to harness the zombie power is interesting. Because it's certainly, I mean, that's our power is harnessed through behaviorism by the state.
Yeah.
You know?
And the prepper culture, though, is really interesting. I know this is kind of a side note, but just how popular that's kind of gotten. But, you know, the end is near idea has been around, I mean, since we have the Book of Revelations, which isn't even speaking about something in the future. It's actually talking about something that's going to happen soon.
Probably even before that. I mean, I guess no.
No.
Viking mythology is not pre-biblical.
A lot of that, though, is kind of apocalyptic, and it's because we are jostling with mortality all the time. This revelation that whenever we die, maybe everything's going to keep going exactly the same, so we weren't important.
Yeah.
But if we're here for when everything goes down, then I don't get to miss out on the party. Yeah, it's the apocalyptic thing. There's so many different religions which are founded on that. Christianity, Revelations is kind of founded on that. Essentially, was you have these Jewish tribes who are basically spreading around this myth that they're the chosen people, suddenly have the Romans who are impinging on this and preventing them from being able to grow. And as a result, well, if we're the chosen people, how can this be possibly the case? Therefore, this must be the end of times.
Yeah.
And it's this consistently sexy idea that we are the chosen people. So even preppers are in the chosen people path. We're the ones who know, and it's all the dumb muggles who don't know.
Part of it, too, is that what goes with that is living in end times. Everyone's always living in end times.
Yeah. It throughout society, things are almost always getting better, and almost everyone in society thinks things are getting worse.
Yeah.
Like, that's the most
consistent.
That's
really odd.
Yeah. It propels things to keep getting better. Because if you're too comfortable, then you don't develop the new smartphone, you don't develop the new technology, you keep on the horse and buggy rather than developing the car.
Yeah.
You're constantly in this state where you're forgetting how many great things you have, but the benefit of that is you consistently are creating better things.
I wonder if it's always been that way, like outside of religion too. Like, I could certainly see how that's been the pattern over the last 100 years, and the reason why I would think it is like, who controls the narrative? You know, who is basically controlling what people see in current events and therefore what becomes history? It's old people.
Well,
people who are becoming increasingly uncomfortable with the world in which they live.
It's so all religion, though. I mean, the state is a religion.
But
right? Progressivism is a religion.
I'm wondering if it's been exacerbated just by how fast things have changed in the last 150, 160 years, where by the time you die, it's a totally different world than the one into which you were born.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So,
and more so all the time.
And faster all the time. So it just seems like as things get better and better, they're just getting worse and worse, because as people get older, they're expressing more discomfort with the changes that they didn't know were coming, that they weren't prepared for.
Leonard Nimoy died recently
at
83.
Mm-hmm.
And he's famous for playing Spock, which is sci-fi, set in the 24th century.
Yeah.
Right. He lived to see things progress beyond many of the gadgets in the show in which he acted as a young man.
Yeah.
In sci-fi.
Yeah.
Like, how bizarre would that be? Like, you wouldn't see that in the Middle Ages. You wouldn't see, like, oh, we wrote this fantastic prophecy of a plow that was way more efficient than the plow we use now, and I lived to see it. Like, that didn't happen in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
Except for maybe, like, big inventions like air balloons or something.
But we've even had
commas.
Commas.
They figured out a lot of grammar during the Middle Ages. That was pretty much it. Like, if you read a book where they're like, oh, it wasn't that bad in the Dark Ages, they figured out how to do periods.
Okay.
Like, oh, but yeah, we have, like, the internet now, so this is way better.
But we've seen that on a smaller scale in much shorter lives. How old are you?
I'm 34.
Okay, I'm 37. You're
27.
27. So sometime when we were all between the ages of, 12 and 2, well, you might have been a little young. Back to the Future Part 2, which took place in 2015.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember seeing that, and I was like, wow, will the future really be that way? And that future sucks compared to the real 2015.
Other than the floating skateboard.
Yeah.
That thing would be so bad. But, like, where's the government in that movie? You think kids are going to have floating skateboards?
Well, here's the thing about technology. You always got to remember other people are going to have it, too. So when you think about, like, flying cars, everyone always thinks of flying cars as, well, I'll just have the flying car and I can go right over traffic. But they never think about everyone else.
No, look at the Jetsons, man. They had air traffic.
Yeah, they did. You see, Jetsons, they knew what the hell they were doing. But even a lot of the progresses, though, that we have right now, we don't even take a look at them as if they're a big deal. Like, whenever iPhone came out with FaceTime, we were able to do video chat with people, which everybody had been speaking about since the 1980s. Like, oh, this is going to be the next invention. And then suddenly, no one really gives a damn. We all go back to texting, which is just the most mundane form of technology, period.
Yeah, I'm a big P9 guy myself.
Yeah. When I envision my memory, and I close my eyes and I think, remember when I was in high school, remember when I was in middle school, whatever, I can't fathom myself as a smaller person or as a younger person. Or as a different person. Like, in the person playing the character when I run through memories in my mind is always me, as I am now, right? Which is just weird. I don't know if that's everybody has this experience.
You cannot actively try and prevent yourself from realizing things you already know.
Or just be so there. I'm there as me, right?
Like, I think of myself as, like, when I was 15, I thought Howard Dean was pretty cool. I was really worried about burning in hell, and I was trying to convert all my friends to Christianity. I can't put myself in that mindset anymore. I can't even put myself in that body anymore to think in that way. And that's one of the hardest things about empathy, is that once you're in that position where you know what's going on now, it's hard to put yourself in the mindset of someone else.
Yeah. And but what I mean is, it's also hard for me to envision technological progress this way. Like, it's hard for me to imagine when the internet was starting and I was thinking, you know, someday this could be used for videos.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's hard for me to acknowledge the amount of progress that has occurred in my life, because whenever I think about the past, it still feels like the world. You know what I mean? Like, I felt like I was at the pinnacle of progress when I was 12. I feel like I'm at the pinnacle of progress now.
I never did. I always was saying someday, you know? Hmm. And the some days that were coming were nothing. I mean, like, my conception or my expectation is nothing like what actually happened, you know? But it just happens. So I think the other thing, too, is that it seemed like there was going to be this big unveiling of this new amazing thing, this technological revelation.
It all just gets assimilated into normalcy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Decentralized competition leads to what we have now. And so it takes away some of the grandiosity of it, though. Whenever you just see, like, Samsung and Apple fighting it out in order to create the best cell phone, and then you realize, like, oh, I have this amazing technological capability, and I'm just mad because the battery isn't lasting long enough. So whatever it is, we're going to bitch about it.
Yeah, the progress is invisible for some reason. Maybe it's because it's so incremental.
Yeah.
But people are...
It's not even that incremental, though. I mean, it's incremental in our lives, but over the course of history, I mean, it's insane how quick it went about.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean...
Like, I remember being able to play Snake on a Nokia phone and being blown away because I was used to a DOS computer.
Yeah.
I heard you mention Robert Anton Wilson when you guys were talking while I was setting up. Have you ever read Cosmic Trigger?
I have read Cosmic Trigger. It's a trilogy. I've read all three. I think it's a trilogy.
The Illuminatus is a trilogy. No, Cosmic Trigger is a trilogy.
Cosmic Trigger is. Yeah, yeah. Schrodinger's Cat is a trilogy. I think there's only one Prometheus Rising.
The last Cosmic Trigger, the final secret of the Illuminati, where he goes through the whole Terrence McKenna time scales overlapping thing where, they blew it. It didn't happen, but it was interesting. I remember I read Cosmic Trigger in like 2007, and he's, Terrence McKenna, I don't know if you could maybe sum this up better than me, but Terrence McKenna had tied the whole 2012 thing to some kind of, he was able to overlap like...
Novelty.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the jumping Jesus equation.
Right, right. So that there would be these technological revolutions just doubling faster and faster and faster, and it would all culminate in 2012, and there would be some kind of...
And he could sell that message pretty well. I mean, it was a good marketing.
Especially in marketing like 2007.
Time. Yeah, yeah. Really good marketing at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Even his brother Dennis has like admitted, like, yeah, he didn't necessarily believe that.
You know, that's the opposite religious promise. Like, there is the don't worry about dying and things going on without you because we're all living in end times.
Yeah.
But then there's also, don't worry, you'll live to utopia. It'll happen in your lifetime.
Yeah.
The singularity is upon us. It's like, you know, December 2012.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, guys, you're bringing up in regards to the Terrence McKenna thing, though?
No, I just thought it was interesting because...
Bobby Wilson is one of my pork scouts, named after Robert Anton Wilson.
Awesome. That's the only book I think... I've read some of Illuminatus. I read some of Email to the Universe, but that was the only book I read cover to cover of his.
Yeah. I cried reading that book. The death of Luna, his daughter.
Oh, yeah.
I was heartbroken. Yeah. You know what's funny about all of Robert Anton Wilson is that I don't think I could really speak accurately about it because I read all of it through a Marxist lens. So, like, to really, like, get it now, I think I'd have to read it all again.
Yeah. That's another interesting thing, too, that kind of relates to what you were saying about always picturing, you know, yourself now or you, Carlos, not being able. And that is a tricky thing to empathize with those path.
Yeah, because here's the recognition in regards to that.
Well, hold on a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
That is a tricky thing to empathize with past selves.
Well, a lot of hostility that we have towards others is hostility that we had towards our prior selves.
Yeah.
You believe that? And then you think about, oh, man, I was so dumb when I used to believe that. So I'm going to tell this person as if they were the me from back then, as if they went through all the exact same changes that I did that led to me believing that particular thing and acting as if that's going to work.
That's what conversion zealotry is.
Yeah.
That when whatever they're converting to, when a person converts from one thing to another, they go through like a year of insane fundamentalist zealotry where they feel the need to like preach it at everyone.
Yeah, no, it's certainly there, and it's also a lack of recognition of the changes that you had to do yourself in order to get where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't go from, you know, giving out the flesh of Jesus to people to immediately the next day reading, you know, Richard Dawkins and being like, yeah, this is awesome. You know, there was a lot of different steps that I took in order to get there. And the chaos of people's minds, and I think this is where people are trying to find order out of chaos of consciousness through behaviorism, which is, oh, well, if we can just do these simple math problems, we can change the way people think, is that we don't know exactly which interlinking things are going to change a person's mind and what's going to work and what doesn't. And mm-hmm. I get really uncomfortable whenever I hear any person trying to explain, well, this is the exact communication method that you need to use in order to change this person's mind. Because I just think it's mostly bullshit. That's central planning. It's the assumption that everyone's going to be same in this kind of way. Whether it sounds like compassionate communication, nonviolent communication, violent communication, any of these ways, it just depends on the person, depending on what happened in their own lives.
Right, because there's no acknowledgement of the recipient of the argument.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you just kind of figure out where they're going. But I know if, you know, it just depends on the person. Because I knew when I was going through my stuff, even the libertarian ethics stuff, like I was dabbling in nihilism, and my friend came up to me and he just goes like, no, there's ethics. It's wrong. It's wrong to screw kids.
I think
you're right. That was really stupid. That idea was really, really dumb.
I think there are things that are just, they're literally invisible to people at some points in their life. Because when I was reading Robert Anton Wilson and obsessed with it, reading every book that he wrote, I was essentially a Marxist at the time, and I read his stuff, and I said, this is another Marxist, mm-hmm. right? And and then I had to go through Ron Paul and through a minarchist constitutionalist phase and then fall out the other side of that, a voluntarist. And then like I came across this Robert Anton Wilson video on YouTube, and he says he's a voluntarist anarchist, and I'm like, why didn't I hear the word voluntarist? Why didn't I hear the word anarchist? Why didn't I hear the word capitalist when I was obsessed with this author?
You know, I still find myself doing that, like superimposing my current beliefs onto like whatever I'm interfacing with.
Yeah.
And now it's more like I catch myself doing, like I'll see some news story and I'll say, oh, I know what this is. And I'll be totally wrong.
That's the conspiracy theorist mind frame, though, right? Because you create these are the patterns.
Yeah.
Now I can recognize what's going on in human society. It's not all chaos. So therefore, if ISIS does beheadings, well, that's obviously because the American government, yada yada yada. Or that it's fake, which really fucking bothered me.
Or both.
It could be a combination of that too. I just remember, you know, seeing those things and thinking those thoughts, and it was
them
like
being fake pisses you off. I thought they were fake at first.
It's jumping on that immediately, and then that just seems so disrespectful to the people who just lost.
I guess I wasn't certain they were fake. I
remember like Jeff Berwick just posting this thing like, oh, this is absolutely bullshit. I was like, it was kind of like after Sandy Hook when people were saying it was all bull. I was like,
you
have a bunch of dead kids. This is fake.
The thing about, first of all, one pro and one con, or one pro, one against, I should say, the thing that made ISIS seem fake, it was like this cartoonized version of all the things they had been saying about Al-Qaeda since 9/11 that turned out not to be true. So it's like, all right, you shitheads aren't falling for that anymore. We're rolling out this. But the other thing, too, is I learned more about it, and I saw, you know, I mean, I still have a lot of questions, but I saw, like, my initial misconceptions or my initial jumping to conclusions, I started to understand why people use a term like denialist, right? It's not necessarily a pejorative or conspiracy theorist as much as I thought. Like, I just thought they were dismissive terms. But in some people, denialism and conspiracy theorism are essentially patterns of behavior that are very predictable, right? Yeah. So, like, Alex Jones, God bless him, I know what he's going to say about it. I know the angle that he's coming at.
I'm so excited to hear Alex Jones' review of Batman versus Superman.
I know.
Because Batman is a tool of the globalists.
See? Yes.
Yes.
But Superman is a fight for liberty against the collectivist aliens. This was his reviews of these movies,
mm-hmm.
right? And in one, he says all of Hollywood is tools of the globalists, and then the other one he says, well, Hollywood is obviously seeing what I'm seeing and they're trying to expose it, so Hollywood is two-faced. But the thing is,
in Batman versus Superman, it flips it.
In Batman versus Superman, first off, they're all the same writer, so anything he says about the hidden agenda behind Batman and Superman, it's got to be the same, right? Same studio, same writer, same director.
Same Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they're Jews. I haven't verified this yet. But
Superman certainly.
If it follows the comic book, Batman wins. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Which would mean that it's a globalist conspiracy defeating the individualist patriot, whatever good guys.
But Superman is used as a tool of the state in Batman vs Superman.
Yes.
Yeah. So
these are Alex Jones. I have the documents. Okay. Alex Jones is on the record saying that Superman was a positive message that was about attacking the eugenicists because the aliens were the bad guys were the eugenicists, and Superman is whatever. What does Alex Jones even call himself? Is he a patriot?
He is the head of the Liberty community, right?
He would call himself a liberal in the classic.
Classical liberal.
Sense. So, he would call himself a patriot. He would call himself a libertarian.
The Superman movie is an attack on the ideology of the eugenicists by Superman, the classical liberal hero.
Yeah.
But he's defeated by the globalists.
The new
the
one
sequel.
Where Zod comes and tries to terraform the Earth.
Yeah. So that means that Alex Jones has to admit, once Batman defeats Superman, that he was set up to be knocked down thinking that Superman was originally a classical liberal hero story.
Yeah. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Guys, we're out of time. So, Davi, can you plug your stuff for us? Where can people learn more of you?
Go to SurvivorMax.com. You can read the first chapter of the book there, and you can order the Kindle version or the paperback or whatever. And if you want to pay with Bitcoin, you actually can't do it there, but you can get the book for Bitcoin at ShinyBadges.com.
Awesome. And what is ShinyBadges.com, just for people who don't know?
It's you've heard the jingle on LRN, I'm sure.
Yes,
it's just libertarian, anarchist, voluntarist merch. Mm-hmm. Shiny badges are these like kind of gold embossed lapel pins. They're not like punk buttons, right? They're like the kind of thing a politician would wear, like your black and yellow flag pins and stuff like that. And then I've also got like patches and t-shirts and some other stuff there, but the cop block badge is there, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And any place people can hear you talk?
FreedomFiends.com.
Awesome.
I'm a semi-regular co-host on the Freedom Fiends.
Excellent. Carlos, give your website.
Well, you can find my book at legallykidnapped.net. It's called Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services. And you can also go to truthovercomfort.org. That is .org, not .net anymore, to check out my podcast and everything else.
Excellent. And that's it?
That's it. That was awesome. It's fun.
Dobby, thank you so much. That was terrific.
Sure.
Thank you, audience.
I think I just spoiled more of the book than I have anywhere else, but that's okay.
Hey, everybody. This is Brett again. Just wanted to throw up one outtake at the end. This is actually a part of a discussion that took place while we were taking an intermission, and there wasn't really a way to integrate it seamlessly into the rest of the show. So I thought I'd just slap it up at the end. Thanks again to Davi, to Carlos, and we'll be back in a couple of days. Bye.
Somewhat plausible.
God, you told me yesterday that it had to do with the bomb in the brain. I didn't realize it was that fucking explicit in it.
Oh, yeah.
That's so great. God, I really want to read this now. Yeah, I'm so excited. That's awesome. That you just put
I call it the beast in the brain.
The beast in the brain.
Yeah, because it's animal, right? Zombies are sort of more animal than bomb.
Yeah.
Right? But because Stefan is trying to say the state in the brain, right? And so the bomb is a really nice substitute for the state because they're the only ones that bomb.
Yeah.
But for me, it's the animism or animalisticness, right? It's the primitive mind.
Yeah.
So it's the beast in the brain.
Limbic system, right? Which is, you know, our lizard brain. And that's
it's the amygdala and the hippocampus specifically. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it, so the idea is, so in reality, the ACE study shows that there's this sort of like gap or damage that exaggerates the effect of the amygdala and the hippocampus, right?
And prevents the continual progress of the neofrontal cortex,
right,
which is our conceptual brain.
So that's the pre-infected human,
mm-hmm,
right? So the psychoclass A kid has a healthy hippocampus, a healthy amygdala, a healthy prefrontal cortex. The psychoclass E person has a damaged amygdala, damaged scar tissue in the brain, right? So the parasite sits in that gap between the amygdala and the hippocampus, right? And it goes to the amygdala and it says, we don't have fear anymore. We don't have flee anymore. We just have fight. We just have eat.
Yeah.
And then it says to the hippocampus, we don't have satiation anymore. We just have hunger. Right?
Yeah.
That's a zombie.
Yeah, that is exactly it. And, God, I run into that in real life on a constant basis.
Yeah.
Whenever I have to, like, talk to normal people. And it's terrible because, I really fight against using terms like muggles or sheeple whenever people throw this out.
Yeah.
But sometimes you run into it and you're like, fuck, you're just going with it. You just assume everything you heard on CNN was right.
Yeah.
And like I have this roommate, you know, I was living with for a while, and he would just say exactly what he heard Wolf Blitzer say, like word for word back
to
me.
Isn't that weird?
Like talking points, and I just
look
at him.
That's what ditto head means, right?
Yeah. I just look at him. I'm just like, do you really believe this shit?
Yeah.
Like, and then I'll explain like evidence to the contrary and everything else, and it's like a block, and the argument is the same as the religious argument. So I kind of state that I am an atheist who happens to be a libertarian rather than a libertarian who happens to be an atheist. I kind of take the point of view that the state itself is a religion. My biggest issue in the world as a whole is the idea of faith. Mm-hmm. And when I hear these people talk, you know, the last bit of information they'll do is, well, that's just your opinion. And when I'm in a religious debate, the last note they have is, well, you just have to have faith. And to me, they're saying the exact same thing. There is no truth. Right, it's all just a matter of it's different shades.
Yeah,
right? It's a nihilistic undertone that is being shot forward without them even realizing the fact that they're using nihilism in their argument.
Yeah,
Nietzsche actually discussed Christianity as being purely nihilistic.
Okay, I always wonder about that argument. If you just have to do something, why don't you just do the other thing?
Yeah,
right. Yeah. You know,
Nietzsche said.
Okay, because the Bible itself is so filled with contradictions and different random commandments that don't have any kind of consistency, you're living in a world of complete contradiction.
Okay.
Yeah. Right? So it is nihilistic. It's not, it is, when someone states like, oh, well, saying that there's objective morality is religious, it's like, no, that's saying the exact opposite.
So it the effect of saying there is no truth is the same, you know, as far as practical living or thinking is concerned, as saying God has a plan.
Yeah, because it's all the locus of control is removed from you and onto an external authority that has no reason, rhyme or reason whatsoever.
Yeah.
Right? So it prevents you from being able to decipher what is true and what is false. And that's what religion does, and that's what the state does, and that's what every agency that is looking to strike fear in your heart so that they can control. Individual autonomy is the greatest threat to all of it. Right, the idea that you have the ability to be able to critically analyze and figure out what is fact and what is fiction.
Right.
And without that kind of empowerment, we're going to get fucking nowhere.
So let's pick it back up. I'll throw that at the end.
Okay.
Just a little, hey, here's an outtake.
Yeah.
So I'll just prompt the behaviorism question.